Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Well, I don't share much, so let's forget about that. I know a lot, and I remember a lot. I've got, somehow at my fingertips, answers. I kind of know where the bodies are buried.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org presents Evolutionaries. Florence Fabricant, or FloFab. Florence Fabricant is one of the most influential and renowned food writers in the country. As a columnist, she has contributed to the New York Times dining section for over 30 years. As an author, she's published more than 11 cookbooks. When Florence writes, the food world listens. Few have been as consistent and forward-thinking as FloFab, who started her career in food before words like artisanal, sustainability, and locavore were ever a thing.
Today, the interesting thing is that food has become much more important and respected. You can get degrees in food studies, which you couldn't before. And for the longest time, most publications, except for the dedicated food magazines, did not think much of food lifestyle, that kind of coverage. It's been a long, hard journey to get the kind of respect that it has now achieved. You've now got a food writer who got a Pulitzer. You know, that's pretty amazing. I'm very aware of the responsibility and the fact that anything I say is being represented by the New York Times, so I don't take it lightly. I'm very careful as to elements like the honesty, authenticity, etc. of anything that I do write about. And I'm aware of the power and the responsibility. I know that I can put a product on the map, and I have done it many, 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 many times. But to me, it's got to be a worthwhile product. And it's got to be worthwhile in the sense of appealing to my palate, in the sense of not being just some kind of copycat thing, in the sense of having been developed by people who know what they're doing. And there are so many elements involved. It's really hard to say exactly what triggers the decision for coverage. But believe you me, you don't want to look in my refrigerator because, as my husband says, there's no food in here. It's all pickles and mustards and honeys and jams that come flowing in over the transom. I wish people wouldn't send me stuff without checking with me first, because very often it's stuff I've either just written about or stuff that I'm not interested in. And the hardest thing is when somebody approaches you with a new product and they think they've reinvented the wheel. And it's very hard to say, I'm sorry, but we're not interested in covering this right now. It's really hard, because I know people put their hearts and souls and wallets into everything, into what they do. For example, somebody approaches me with a new artisanal sounding product. My first question is, where is this produced? And if they say, well, I'm working from my kitchen, I won't cover it. It's got to be from a credible production source.
Florence Fabricant started her career in 1972, writing for the East Hampton Star. It was a time before people thought about food in terms of seasons.
I grew up in a family that my parents back in, we're talking the 40s and the 50s, my parents were foodies back then. They went to every new restaurant. My mother had her favorite French restaurants in New York. When I was growing up, my father would take me to lunch at Chambord, which was a fancy French restaurant in a storefront on 3rd Avenue under the L. And we had this little ritual. In the window, they had these champagne bottles of all the different sizes, and I wouldn't go in until he named everyone, you know, Jeroboam and Nebuchadnezzar, and I was just fascinated with that. And the Four Seasons, the Forum of the 12 Caesars, I can remember going to some of these great restaurants, the original Ruby Foo's. This was growing up. My mother was also a terrific cook, and this was at a time when a lot of people didn't cook well and didn't dine out to this extent. That said, I lived in Paris for a year while I was in college, And after college, I started working in market research and advertising. And then when my children started school full time, I tried to figure out what to do. I thought about law school. My husband, who's a lawyer, discouraged me. And I was considering a graduate program. I won't bore you with the details of what happened with that. But we were summering in the Hamptons. We had a house in Waynescott, which is part of East Hampton. And the East Hampton Star, a weekly newspaper, did not have a food column. And I was enraged to see people buying iceberg lettuce or those packets of cellophane-wrapped pinkish tomatoes in the middle of the summer when you could go a couple of blocks down the road and buy somebody's fresh tomatoes from a card table they set up on their front lawn. And so I pitched the idea of a food column to the editor of the Star, and he thought that was a good idea, and I wrote a sample, and he accepted it, and he agreed to pay me because that was part of the deal. I wouldn't do it for free. And within 6 months, I was starting to get assignments from the Times and never looked back. This is not anything I can advise anybody to do, except to say if there's an opportunity to write anything for anybody, even if it's a weekly country newspaper, do it, if that's what you want to do. Now, the fact that Craig Claiborne lived in East Hampton and read my stuff, along with a number of other New York Times people, probably didn't hurt.
In the 30-plus years that passed since her first food article, astronomical changes have taken place in the way we think about what we eat.
I think the food culture has become an engine of itself, and people are much more interested and much more compulsive about the whole food scene. And if you hear it said that people aren't cooking, that's not true. People are cooking, and they're buying expensive cooking equipment. And it's not just the fancy stove that's sitting unused in a Park Avenue apartment. People are cooking. People are interested in what's going on the food scene with a kind of passion that might have just been addressed to new cars or fashion or architecture. It's all of a piece. There's nothing that escapes our view. And when you have an editor whose mandate is to make a food section as good as it can be, then the editors see to it that presumably that this will happen and get the writers to do various stories. But the editors did not make food big in New York. The Times was the first to have a dedicated food section. But nonetheless, I have copies of Gourmet Magazine going back to 1948. And I can still find recipes that sound new because, for whatever reason, I hadn't seen them before. Or reports from Samuel Chamberlain on Paris and Lucius Beebe, all kinds of writing back in those days and what people were eating. And yes, it's changed tremendously, but on the other hand, maybe it hasn't changed so much.
Like many people of her generation, Florence remembers a time when food often meant France, and things like croissants were considered exotic in New York City.
I came back from living in Paris in 1957 and wanted everything French, wanted croissants. You could maybe get a decent croissant. My mother and I would go around, and my mother was one of the first customers at William Greenberg's bakery. We lived in Westchester, but she was in Manhattan all the time. And the place I think that we found the croissants that pleased me the most were Macy's, which had a very different food retail of setup in those days. I was frustrated by the cheeses. So frustrated, you have no idea. There were good French restaurants in New York in those days. I remember going to Voisin, my first time I've ever had Gâteau Saint-Honoré. I mean, I really remember that. I know that in the 50s and in the late 50s especially was when food started to become exciting in New York. It was when restaurant associates under the leadership of Joe Baum got going and started opening these restaurants. The Four Seasons opened in 1959. Hotel dining even got better. In terms of food shopping, it was never easy. You could buy really good meat. You could always buy good meat. Fish was a much narrower range in terms of what was available. You know, there was a whole progression. It started to ramp up gradually and continued along those lines. Because by the 60s is when you began to get the beginnings of, you know, the fast food chains. And they were in a different orbit from what my interests were, but it was along a parallel stream. By the 70s, in terms of restaurants, you kept getting more. And retail food shopping began to improve with the opening of places like Dean and DeLuca. Balducci's had been there for a long time. And, you know, it just kept evolving. When you began to get the whole environmental side to what food is and food production practices, I mean, who knew the word, forgive me, heritage in terms of food even 15 years ago? The big change that I see is that when I first started, I'll give you an example. I did an article about goat cheese. I think it was 1979. I did this article on goat cheeses. And at the time, I bought every goat cheese I could find in the three or four, half a dozen New York stores that handled fine cheeses. Not a single one was domestically made. And I found 12. Within 5 years, you could probably buy 100, to give you one example. At that time, you could get excited about a new mustard, green peppercorn mustard, wow, and could write about it. Today, give me a break. There are so many mustards. There are so many olive oils. There are so many vinegars. I remember first encountering balsamic vinegar in Modena and seeing the little barrels lined up in a cellar and tasting different balsamics. And that was in the early 80s, like 83, 84, somewhere around then. And in fact, my daughter was living in Florence, Italy, and studying with a family at that time. I think it was about 1984. And we brought them a bottle of balsamic vinegar to Florence, Italy. They had never heard of it, didn't know what it was. And now, of course, you know, you can get balsamic flavored shoe polish if you wanted to. And there's just such an explosion. And yes, email. I get pitches all the time, too many on email. And the only thing I really object to is pitches from people who haven't done their homework and haven't realized that something that they are suggesting I wrote about 2 years ago, 5 years ago, or whenever. And this happens frequently. And it wastes my time, and I wish they wouldn't. Yes, there's new stuff in the discussion to a certain extent. The kind of work that's being done up in Pleasant Ridge Reserve, and the other one, Rush Creek, that's almost like a vacherin. I mean, I see something like that, and I'm as excited as if I had discovered goat cheese for the first time back in 1979. So there is always something new. What's going on with grains these days and with baking? On the other hand, what's going on with gluten-free, I mean, I think it is so overdone and such overkill and lack of understanding of what the problem with gluten is. And selectively, yes, I will cover certain items that are made gluten-free, because there is a market now, and it's not just people who genuinely get sick from it, but there's just so much. And yet, even though there is so much, there's new stuff going on all the time, and it's very exciting.
While at large, most people are becoming more educated when it comes to food, there are still some people chasing trends that miss the point. So So where does the line between intention and quality lie?
I think a lot of chefs who contend that they're buying from local farms really aren't. You see stuff on menus that is laughable. I go into a market and I see, for example, a fillet of fish that was called wild striped bass, and I knew from looking at it, it wasn't wild striped bass. I mean, this kind of thing goes on all the time. You can close your eyes. Like in the old days, you knew what a red sauce Italian restaurant was. You knew what the decor was going to be. You knew what the wine list was going to be. You could know the menu without even looking at it. Today, you go into any new restaurant, especially in Brooklyn, but elsewhere as well, and you know that it is going to, you're going to be told about how everything that's on the walls and the floor and the table is recycled. You're going to be told how the chef sources everything from local farms, how the chef makes everything in-house from the pickles on down. I mean, it has become so copycat that I just wonder what's going on here. Classic French and classic Italian, these should not be ignored, especially classic French. And this idea that classic French is all about butter and cream. Classic French is also a lot about balance, the kind of balance a lot of chefs today don't have a clue about. For instance, a lot of chefs don't understand acidity. If a dish doesn't have or even a wine doesn't have an element of acidity, it's boring, it's flat, it's fat, and it is not enjoyable to eat. It's almost like you bought the restaurant from a catalog, and it's the same catalog everybody is using. I don't know how many restaurant chefs or owners have sat in their own restaurant when it's crowded and had a meal to understand things like lighting and noise and the comfort of the seats and the tables. A place like Roberta's, it's casual, it's pizza. You put up with anything because it's really good. But where you're going to start spending $50 or more per person, these things should be noticed. I was in a restaurant recently where the tables were just too high. Somebody, and I'm not a small person, but somebody never sat at a chair and realized that the level of the table was practically up to their collarbone. That is uncomfortable. You're better off eating at a lower table than a higher table. So few people understand that.
Florence has helped publish some of the best cookbooks of our generation, including the New York Restaurant Cookbook, Florence Fabricant's Pleasures of the Table, and Park Avenue Potluck.
One of the cookbook projects that I really loved was a cookbook about Venice. That was the first one that I worked on with my daughter. It was with Francesco Antonucci, who now owns Antonucci on the Upper East Side, and Adam Tahani, who was involved with Francesco at the time in Remy. And we all went trooping off to Venice for a week and went to markets and went to restaurants and interviewed cooks and winemakers. And there was a photographer along. I mean, it was just a glorious time, and I loved working on that book. And then it was, I knew how chefs function in the kitchen, but it was really kind of fun because Francesca would be cooking these recipes and I'd be taking notes. And one of the first thing I did was brought him measuring cups and measuring spoons because I wanted the recipes to be able to be user-friendly for the home cook. And I'll never forget, he's about to put olive oil into a pan, and I hand him a tablespoon. So he holds the tablespoon. He starts pouring the oil. The oil flows all over the table. You know, he isn't measuring. He's just pouring it into the tablespoon and letting it pour back into the pot. It was just so funny. I now often get recipes from chefs, and most of the time, they're broken down from a much larger quantity. So when you do that, things change. And I'll never forget the time I got a recipe for a sauce, I guess a vinaigrette or something, that had half teaspoon each of four kinds of vinegar. Now, that's ridiculous. Or a recipe that calls for two haricot verts. That's ridiculous. With the four vinegars, I called the chef and I said, look, no four vinegars, pick two. And, you know, I knew that wouldn't destroy the recipe. But, you know, when you're cooking preparing a vat of stuff, yeah, you can put in a cup each or a liter each of four kinds of vinegar, no problem. But when you're breaking it down to a portion for four people, it doesn't work.
Florence Fabricant is a woman who's seen, done, and eaten more than most can hope to in a lifetime. She's conquered New York, traveled the world, and has always maintained a standard of integrity that's second to none.
Travel isn't cheap, but it adds layers to the complexity of your experience and your outlook. You don't have to insist that the Italian food here is authentic by the standards of Rome or Venice or Florence or Naples. On the other hand, there are certain attitudes and practices that you will pick up in your travels, or I think I've picked up in my travels, that do translate and give me a better perspective. For example, in Italy, you get a bowl of pasta. First of all, it's not half a pound of pasta. It can be consumed by one person, which I find impossible at a lot of places here. The portion sizes here drive me crazy. Number one. Number two, when you get a bowl of pasta in Italy, when you have finished your bowl of pasta, there is no sauce left in the bottom of the bowl because the proportions are so perfect. That's just a small lesson learned. The way the French serve cheese. Yes, there are a lot of great cheeses here. And my mind is blown by the wonderful cheeses being made here now. But on the other hand, you go to France and you will still find cheeses that you cannot find here that haven't been replicated here. I've heard that people are afraid of me, and I don't understand why they're afraid of me. They have no reason to be. By and large, what energizes me is the news, and it always has. Learning something new, tasting something new, seeing somebody do something new that I hadn't been aware of. And as much food as there is out there, and goodness knows there's more than ever, there's always something new out there. And that's what fascinates me.
This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research from Patrick Martins. Music was provided by the California Honeydrops, Alan Wilkes, Shadowbox, The Hollows, and Tom Cruise. Thanks for listening, and visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for all of our programming and more information.